Welcome. You're listening to Raw Health Rebel Podcast with Lisa Strabak. It's time to disrupt the current view of health and return to the raw basics that true wellness comes from within. In this episode, I speak to Joe Notabart, a two-time world Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu champion whose passion lies in permaculture, which is also known as regenerative agriculture. Joe explains how the omnivore's dilemma first sparked his interest in permaculture and how he managed to incorporate its principles even while living in central London. Joe explains the core principles of permaculture and why it could feed the planet 10 times over, despite the mainstream doom and gloom narrative of overpopulation. We explore the problems of monoculture and industrial agriculture and how this is currently turning the earth into a giant dust bowl with poor quality food that wreaks havoc on our gut microbiome. We chat about the implications of the veganism movement and problems of soya. Joe illustrates an example of permaculture in the English Kent countryside with pigs and chickens living symbiotically in a copse, which would normally be viewed as wasteland by industrial farmers. Joe also discusses his positive view for the world and future outcome when we realise that we can feed the world and how we've been manipulated into thinking there's a fossil fuel scarcity and where people can make a start with permaculture. You might hear us refer to our mutual friend Sophia, who got us introduced. Both Sophia and Joe live on the beautiful island of Mallorca, and I'm very jealous and hope to visit soon.
Oh no, it's awesome. So you're over in Mallorca at the moment, are you?
Right. So yeah, I've lived here for 5 years now. I'm originally from the States. I'm from Arizona. After the financial crash, I was in the mortgage and real estate industry up until 2008, and then it crashed. And the wife that I was married at the time was British, or she's from London. And so we moved to London in 2008. Lived there for 8-9 years. That didn't work out. and so now, given the choice, I managed to get a British passport out of the deal.
And so
that was my passport out of Britain at the time, because I wanted to live here in Spain, actually. So I did.
Well, do you know what? I tell you what, listening to how lovely it is over there. Sophia, my friend, is trying to convince me that we should all move from the UK to Mallorca. And I have to say it's appealing right now in many ways.
It can be. I think it's appealing. Although I look at it, I do see over the last 5 years, there are people that move here and then will tend to go back. And I think there's a confusion that sometimes I think that it's going to be like a holiday forever. Right. And, that it's going to be cocktails and great weather all the time, but life goes on. And if you've got kids and a family and job and things like that and responsibilities, it's kind of, it turns into to regular life. I mean, it is nice to wake up and have some extra sunshine. That's for sure. I miss London a lot. I mean, it's an amazing city. I really, really liked the city, the restaurants and that sort of lifestyle. And I actually really like the English countryside. I think it's fantastic. It's beautiful. I didn't actually mind the gray skies.
Really?
No. Well, I think also from a permaculture standpoint, it was kind of an amazing place to be. I mean, you didn't have to worry too much about water.
Yeah.
That was not something you had to think about in your system. It's not sweltering hot where things are going to dry up quickly. But it doesn't freeze that much, right? So grasslands tend to do really well. Forests tend to do really well. And from a permaculture perspective, that's very valuable. So I was looking at it from that perspective, and I think that the farms and countryside farms and the rolling hills, especially around Kent, where we were mostly looking around, I thought it was beautiful. Oh, the whole country is fantastic for farming and for permaculture, actually.
Do you know, that's music to my ears, because I'm in West Sussex on the border with Kent, West and East Sussex, actually. I'm right in the middle of it all. So many of my friends at the moment are like, let's go buy some land together and become self-sufficient and just exit this crazy world. So that's music to my ears. So I've got actually some questions that I wanted to ask, like specifically about types of land and things like that. But before we dive into all of that, Can I ask you to just explain to people listening a bit more about you? Why, you know, how did you get into permaculture? And also a lot of people are like, what even is permaculture? So I guess, yeah, why did you get into it and what actually is it?
Let me clarify that. So, I mean, I've been into permaculture since about, well, I want to say 2003. I read The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, that started it. Now that wasn't a book about permaculture, but it was a book about, the history of industrial agriculture, which is almost more important to know. It's almost, you know, how it happened, where these chemicals that Monsanto uses, where they came from, you know, basically their post-war chemicals, nitrogen, that was bomb-making equipment, and they figured out that they could make it into a fertilizer. And it all starts with that story. And then, of course, the American grasslands, which are massive, by the way, you know, they're dousing them, you know, to this day, they're just dumping this multiple poisons on all this land, and it's making its way into the ocean. And so it started with that, and I was kind of like taken back by it. Now, I fell in love with permaculture, but that's one thing, right? That doesn't mean you can make a living at it. Mm-hmm. And what's more important about permaculture, and there's anybody out there that's listening, is that especially if you're in, you know, you have a relationship with somebody, it's kind of something that you need a partner that's willing to be interested in that. Right. Now, my ex-wife and I were really, really good friends. She actually lives here, and we're like best friends, but not interested in it whatsoever. So, you know, when you get into permaculture, the first thing you think of is, I want to get some land, and I want to get a place, and I want to start experimenting on these systems. And that's what permaculture really is. It's a lot about experimentation. You learn about how different systems work depending on the climate and sunshine and how much rain there is and what you like to eat and what the community would like to eat. And you have to integrate all that into making sure that the waste is being recycled. And it's just fun. It'll keep your brain going. It's endless fun. But you typically want to have a partner that's into that too. Mm. Or friends that are into that you can live with, or something to that effect. But not if you have a partner that loves living in central London and likes going to, not no interest in that, then you're going to have a bit of a pool. Now, so I got into permaculture after I met her. We lived in London, and I really took the financial crash in America in 2008 right in the chin. And so London was kind of a new start for me. The UK was a new start for me. I mean, I was literally like one of those movies trying to cross the street, looking the wrong way, almost getting hit by cars, frantic. You know, like everybody's talking funny. I've been a couple times, but I'd never really, really, really been to the UK. And so I got into first, you know, I had to get a regular job, things like that. I got into the travel industry, and but immediately just started doing urban permaculture. Now, urban permaculture is cool and it's great and it's amazing. And it helps you work on things, but you don't have that much space. So you have to. So now I started getting into like putting gardens on the roof, and wow. I was building chicken coop systems that were multi-level. So it was kind of cool that I got to at least use my brain and start thinking about, all right, well, now we've only got a garden that's, you know, 4 meters by 8. And all right, we got to eat off this somehow. So then that's almost more challenging, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I still had chickens, and I really got into designing chicken coops, because, you know, in the UK there's, you know, a big fox population, right? And so you really have to have bulletproof, chicken coop systems, and because of the foxes. And then of course, one side part about the UK is, you know, a lot of slugs and snails. So I was able to use the chickens to work on the slugs and snails, had a nice garden, took out the whole front. We had a little driveway. It was like a terrace house in West Norwood, London, and mm-hmm. just turned that all into boxes. I mean, the neighbors thought it was an absolute quack, just like, who's this American guy that's moved in and just took his whole driveway and just out of a pallet. So I'd find pallets. So it had to be, everything had to be always like recycling, right? You can't just buy brand new wood. It's like, that would have been easy. Much easier than ripping apart pallets. Trust me, ripping apart pallets is hard work, right? Like, you've got a couple big crowbars, you break pallets, start over, put it all together, you have to paint it, all this kind of thing. So I stayed busy with that, kept studying, but I wasn't making a living at it. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, then this started becoming a passion of mine, right? So now this is what I do. But I also, at the time it started, training in a martial art called Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and working my job. So I've got this Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu hobby, this permaculture hobby, and I'm working in the travel industry. And this is like, now this is like 2008 and 2009 and 2010. And the jiu-jitsu thing starts taking off for me better. Okay. And the travel thing's going great. Like, so I got a business and travel, and that's growing. And it was laptop based, and working on a laptop, and it was for film production companies. I found this little weird niche. I found this weird niche where production companies would call me, and like, they need the director and producers and cameramen and all their equipment, we need to go to Chile somewhere and shoot a commercial, and they called Joe. So I managed to build this little business on that with the laptop. Like, but it was kind of cool because I work from home, so I could look at the garden a lot. I mean, my laptop was at the garden and look at the chickens and working and thinking about the tomatoes and why they're not red here. Why it's just like 1 week in August, they finally turn red, you know? And then, learning about the different species, because I've been in Arizona before, right? I mean, I'm from Arizona. It's a completely different climate. Can't be any more different.
Yeah.
Okay. And so as you fall down that rabbit hole, permaculture, and it's deep. It's really deep, and it gets more interesting and more interesting as you do it. You know, I just got more passionate about it, and that's kind of all I wanted to talk to people about. And people kind of look at you like you're kind of weird. You know, it's like a conversation that everybody says they want to do, you know.
Yeah.
I was talking to Sophia about it. She's talking about schools around the island, and yeah, it'd be cool if more schools adopt stuff like this. And I said, yes, and I've tried, but what it is head teachers, and maybe you find this in your area, a lot of them love the idea because they just want the newsletter shot. They want the photo op, they want the kit with the shovel and the gloves and the thing, and so they're learning regenerative and sustainable farming, and then they just move on. But budget-wise and like the real work, and the planning takes a little time. It's a long game. Permaculture is a long game. Regenerative agriculture is another word you could use. So to wrap up my story, I got into the jiu-jitsu thing. It was going great. My ex-partner and I had decided to move to Mallorca. We have a daughter as well, because I had a laptop-based business, right, with the travel thing. And I started like a small jiu-jitsu school here on the island. I just started teaching at the local school, like after school club, just like a couple kids started teaching jiu-jitsu. I competed. I did quite well in that. The kids started to grow, and I started getting more kids, and I wanted to do permaculture, but then, you know, I had to kind of live in it. I had to make money. So I had to keep on with the travel business. So that was eating up a lot of time. I was doing this after school jiu-jitsu thing. Then I started getting more students. And then so I opened up a little space in the little village on the Southwest, and that sort of grew. And then a bunch of students were coming from Palma, but then, which is about only 20 minutes away. And in Mallorca, 20 minutes is like, oh, it's the longest drive ever for them.
Oh, no.
They can't take it. They're like, oh, it's the end of the world. They can't, it's like so far. So I opened up a place in Palma. So anyway, we have two schools now, and that's my full-time job now, is I have two martial arts studios with about 100 students. And I kind of run that full-time. I love that. I love it. I love teaching kids. I love teaching adults. I like taking people that are haven't done any fitness in 20 years and getting them in shape and talking to them about their diet, and doing the right things to keep their body healthy and watching them grow. That's amazing. But permaculture is my true love by far. And so I still am not, I'm going to make it part of my life somehow, even if it doesn't, I don't, but I realize I don't have to be a farmer, right? There's other ways. All I care is that everybody knows about it. So I started when I was in the UK around 2013, I started to get involved in filming different farms. I thought, well, let's get the word out. So what I can do is, since I'm in front of a computer a lot, and I've got a friend that has a nice camera, and he's because I'm doing this film business travel thing, I started to get to know a lot of directors and stuff. And so we, you know, made friends and would maybe go to a farm and film different things and film some of the systems. And I thought, well, being a permaculture presenter might help spread the word, right? I don't have to be a farmer. I wasn't even thinking about how to monetize it. I just like, just get it up on YouTube. It'll be free. Who cares? Like, people just need to know about it, because that's all I wanted. That's all I wanted. Now that even became kind of difficult because cameramen have to be paid, and or their time's valuable. And so the Mallorca move happened, and here I am. And that's how I got to Mallorca, and that's where I'm at now. So like Sophia, she's got a nice piece of property. She's got a really beautiful piece of property. And so I'm going to try and just work with that and come up with different systems for her and take our time with it and see what we can come up with. I guess the most important thing, let's start with that, right? About that people should know about permaculture or regenerative agriculture, okay? Mm-hmm. Most important thing is that they need to realize, because the reason most people love it, I'm gonna get back to this, most people love it and they talk about it like head teachers or just this casual person that likes to just recycle some things, they love it, but in the back of their head, or somehow they've been convinced through media, through the system, I don't know what it is, somehow they've been convinced that the population of Earth is so big, because there's 7.8 billion people, it's so big that we have to have industrial agriculture, okay? And so the only thing I want everybody to know is that is not true. That is not true at all. Permaculture, regenerative agriculture could feed the entire planet 10 times over, right? If done properly. And the very wealthiest person on the planet or the very poorest person on the planet would have access to the same quality food. Now, they might be able to hire a cook that can make it better and a chef that can make it better, but the actual quality of the food would be the same. And of course, there might be a difference in region, right? Desert lamb might not taste as nice as English lamb because of the grass content or something like that. But so that's the first thing I want most people to know is that the more people that get involved with it, the more people will start to understand that there's actually not a population problem if you layer regenerative agriculture on top of the planet. With industrial agriculture, it is already being maxed out. There's a limit. It's very linear, I guess you could say. That makes any sense?
Yeah, and do you know what? That gave me chills when you said that. I've heard that before and a whole heap of other sources, nothing to do with agriculture, but actually that, we're not overpopulated necessarily in terms of how we've been programmed that we are. So when you said that, I'm like, yes, we need to know this, and I think, maybe up until now, permaculture hasn't, isn't as mainstream, but I really hope it does go that way because so many people, I think, are thinking now they want to go off grid or they want to be more self-sufficient or, and this, it's great because I think it is what the world needs. So what, like, where would you start? Like, what is the, is there a place to start? Is it like one of those things that just really, it sounds like it is really individual depending on where you are and what land you've got and all of that. But what is the sort of core principles, I guess?
Well, there are different ones. I mean, for a person to start out in it, the permaculture is let's talk about the word, right? Permaculture means permanent agriculture. And so, but another popular word that means really the same thing is regenerative agriculture, right? And I think the word, let's say the previous 15, 20 years was sustainable agriculture. Now sustainable, if you think about the word sustain, that means you're just sustaining, right? That means if you've got a piece of property and you grow some things on it, you want to sustain its ecology. Regenerative agriculture means every year on year, you're actually regenerating it. A piece of regenerative property, and the same with permaculture, because permaculture and regenerative are basically the same thing, they're the same word, really. That means that a permaculture farmer year on year needs to sequester more carbon into the soil, needs to emit more oxygen into the atmosphere, needs to produce a little bit more food every year, and so it needs to go positive in all the right directions. So it's regenerating, it's getting better. Another thing to know about a permaculture farm that's really interesting is it's one of those kind of places that it's based on a mimic nature system, right? So you're kind of looking at everything, this is why it's so fun because it's like a puzzle. and you're learning along the way. There's, you know, there's, and I'm by no means some super expert. There are a lot of people out there better than me that are doing it every single day and have for 20, 25 years. And they're going to know a lot more, at least about their particular climate, their zone, that's what we call it, right? Every person needs to look at regenerative agriculture differently, because not everybody can do it. Mm. People are busy, right? People are very busy in life. And it's, you know, a lot of times they don't think they have the time for it. Now, you don't have to. That's the thing. One thing you can do is, instead of doing permaculture at your house, for example, or your apartment or anything, is to try and purchase from regenerative sources. Okay, so that's helping permaculture by doing that. You know, sort of trying to stay away from things that are industrial, or trying to stay away from things that are monoculture. Another part of it's diet. So I started a website. I had it up for years. It was called the Paleo Permaculture Connection. And it's because one thing that's really cool about permaculture is that whole foods generally tend to work better in it, where grain type things don't.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So the idea was, not saying don't eat grain, because I love ciabatta bread just next to the next person, but to maybe reduce grain consumption, which is definitely something to get it to that price, it's definitely something that has to be monoculture. Do you know the difference between monoculture and polyculture? So monoculture, for your listeners, monoculture is when you plant something and it's just one species. So like when you're going through the English countryside and you see those yellow flowers, and that's usually rapeseed.
Yeah.
So that's going to be for oil, which is not even a great oil to cook with, because you heat that up and it turns into trans fat immediately. But that's just miles and miles and miles of the same crop, which is rapeseed. And so that's a monoculture. A polyculture would be when you mix species together. So when you look at a forest, like a wild forest, that's already naturally a polyculture, right? Because there's an oak tree, and there's a cherry tree, and there's that tree, and there's some bushes there, and there's some grasses there, and a pasture, you know, when you see a wild pasture, or a grassland, a real wild grassland, that'll have 10 different species of sedges and weeds and different types of grasses and little bushes. That's a polyculture, a wild ecosystem where things are working together there. Right. And as far as cattle go, they love that. That's like a salad bar for them. They love to, like, they'll eat what their body wants. Right. And so that's a mimic nature system. So in a cattle producing sort of farm, you would probably have lots of different animals. That would be a polyculture of animals. And then you'd have a polyculture pasture. Okay. Now, another thing, back to the rapeseed and monocultures tend to be planted as annuals. And this is a big problem. Annuals means that you have to plant the seed every year. Okay. And this, I'm going to get back to the massive problem with monoculture, agriculture, and what an annual is. So an annual is something that you plant every year, and then it grows, and then you harvest it. When you harvest it, you kill everything. When you kill everything, everything dies, and you're just left with the dirt. And then you wait till the winter passes, and then the spring comes around, and you plant a seed, and then it grows. And then you keep going through this process, right? Mm-hmm. Annuals and monocultures, because they're so unnatural, right? Nothing in nature just grows like that. Nothing grows alone like that. It needs other plant species to interact with, to fight with, to confuse pests and things, that they realize that pests are a problem, because pests look at it as like an infinite amount of the same food, right? They go, well, there's these rape seeds here. Let's eat. There's bazillions of them. It's a bonanza. They're not running into any other species, right? So farmers have to use a pesticide. They have to use a pesticide because, you know, the crop's going to get wiped out. Well, okay, now they've killed these pests. A lot of times what they use, this is the creepiest part, they'll use a seed, right? They do this with soybean, which soybean isn't good for you anyway, but where they've put the chemical of the pesticide inside the soybean, so it's part of its genetic makeup. This is genetic modification, right? So that when the bug eats it, the bug explodes. right?
Yeah, and then we're eating it nice.
It's got it. And they go, oh, but it won't hurt humans. It's like, well, because it's so little. But like, well, I don't know. Really? Okay, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow. But what happens in like 10 years when like cancer popped up? And they go, oh, sorry, you just got cancer. We don't know what's from. They don't know where it came from, right? So that's a problem with annuals and monoculture. The second part is, well, now you've got this big monoculture, and then there's weeds growing. That makes it hard to harvest. So then they need a herbicide, right? Douse it with the herbicide. But the herbicide, again, that's another, because in this particular seed, they've made the seed resistant to the herbicide, right? Like they've given the seed like a vaccine of the herbicide. So that when the herbicide hits the seed, the rapeseed plant, for example, it doesn't affect the plant, but it kills all the other weeds. Right. By the way, it kills all the other weeds. Oh, by the way, it kills all the microorganisms in the soil, by the way, that the pesticides didn't already kill. The herbicides is going to kill it. Right. And now they want fast growth. So that's the second thing they douse on it. And then the third thing they douse on, now they want faster growth and more stronger growth because, you know, the soil is so dead because it's been doused with herbicide that killed all the nutrients in the soil. So sand, it's been doused with pesticide, which also killed anything else, worms and all the microorganisms that help push fertilizer into the plant, killed it all. You're left with sand, right? You're left sand. We got to put some synthetic fertilizer on. Now they've doused it with fertilizer, right? And now you get your food, your corn or whatever, your wheat. And that's how the world works right now. That's how the world works. That's what the world is covered in right now. Covered in. And right now, as we speak, it's not changing. It's predominantly that. It's changing a little bit, but here's the kicker. So then people will say, well, the rapeseed's, at least the rapeseed's growing and it's emitting oxygen. Okay, it is a little bit, but then they come by with this big massive tractor and they just chop it all up. They chop it up and it kills it. Now you're left with, here's what you're left with now. Now you're left with a desert dust bowl. Right behind you, right in England. It's happening all over England, all over Great Britain, all over America, all over Europe. This is happening every autumn, all the way through winter and into spring and into the summer. This is happening. It's a massive dust bowl, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why the planet's actually warming. It's because of that action, because it's creating a desert that used to be a grassland, a forest. And those kinds of places, grasslands and forests, the bison that used to roam around North America, right? There are a million bison, million big, huge, same size as cows, which are the same amount of cows that there are in factory farms in America, right? But they were moving along grasslands, okay? These polyculture of grasslands. And when they ate, you know, when bison eat and cows eat and sheep eat, they bite the grass. They don't pull up the roots. They actually give it a haircut that actually like gives it a nice little massage. Right? Gives a nice little massage and actually induces growth. But they don't kill it. The grassland, the pasture is in the forest. These are like living, they live throughout the whole year. That's a perennial, right? That's a perennial. It lives throughout the year for years and years and years, and it just keeps regrowing. Trees keep regrowing, they fall, new trees come up, and it just keeps regrowing. That's a perennial. And that collects carbon right out of the atmosphere. And stores it. This is the crazy part about it all. It actually pulls it through the pasture, the grass and the trees, and actually sticks it into the soil. Actually sticks it right into the soil, which plants love, right? Yeah. So you don't need any of these. You don't need any of these like fertilizers, et cetera, et cetera. Problem is that's free and you can't make a commodity out of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't put it on the stock exchange, and Monsanto can't buy this little chemical, you know, and sell it. It's not part of the economy, but it can be. And we'll get to that later, regenerative agriculture and permaculture, 100% can be. I'm trying to think where I started, where I was going with that, segueing into that tangent.
Do you know what though, just to like comment on that, it is scary how artificial everything is. You know, I've never really stopped to think, you know, I'm much more into sort of homeopathy and alternative health, you know, and obviously branching into all areas, but you know, I think this is how artificial, even like if you think you're eating something healthy that's grown naturally, you know, it just makes me think it's completely, everything is so unnatural and there's consequences to all our actions, isn't there? And why we've got such bad gut damage, or, you know, all our guts, if you're eating this kind of food.
Yes. Well, that was the reason it was my site was called Paleo Permaculture Connection. Wasn't just so why were these two things coming together? It was because I was trying to relate the gut biome to the soil. They're the same things. You can take a healthy hunter and gatherer gut, for example. You know, you've got a spoonful of amazing biome in there that's in the billions. Same thing with a teaspoon of soil. But when you overuse antibiotics or all these other drugs that you're putting in your butt, you're killing everything. You're doing the same thing basically to our body that we're doing. We're basically in this industrialized healthcare in the world, right? It's the same thing as industrialized agriculture. And so they're pretty much the same exact thing. It's about the little things that are in our body. It's about the little things that are in the soil that make this whole thing work properly.
And actually just one thing, two things you mentioned just then. So actually, Sophia, so I'm going to talk about Sophia in the intro, but Sophia, my friend who introduced us, she told me to watch the documentary Kiss the Ground. Have you seen that?
You know, I will say it's, I've watched them all, but it's the best one.
I started it last night and it was late, so I didn't get to finish all, but it was amazing. I want to finish it, but it talked about, and these were questions that Sophia had. So it said about how we need to put plants. Well, Sophia asked, what plants can we put in our gardens to draw down carbon?
Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no. Sorry. What you were going to say? It depends on.
It depends on your climate, you know, but it'll be a polyculture for sure of things. You want to find out what all plants do in the scent. They're all bringing but it needs to be something that stays around for a while. Mm-hmm. And you really have to, and you want to keep soil covered. Ground cover is key. If you look at, you ever been into, I'm sure you have, you walk into a forest and there's something that's so soft about a forest. Like that soil is really rich. That just has, an untouched forest. If you find an untouched forest and you walk in it, like its soil is perfect. Its soil is perfect. And so you want to make a farm, you want to mimic that soil that's in a forest into your farm, you know? So you've got so Spain will have a different set of plants than the UK will.
Yeah, no, for sure. And then I guess the other thing that came up in the documentary, which again, you sort of touched on there, was sort of not digging, isn't it? Like we're not meant to dig stuff.
No till, right. No tilling. Yeah. No, try not to, at least. I mean, your kitchen garden, you could, but I mean, you don't need to. It's like it's an old world concept. You know, I've talked to some people around here and they go, oh yeah, that's like an old Majorcan farmer. He must do it a certain way. And I see him out there. He's just tilling. Like industrialized agriculture has been around for pretty much like 75 years right now. So when you see some old farmer on his tractor and it's like, he's actually doing it wrong. It would have been 200-300 years ago where they would have been doing it maybe a little better. You know, it's the beginning of grain agriculture that really kind of messed things up a little bit. Everyone got obsessed with grains. That's when monoculture really started to kick in. The tilling, in that video, you would have seen, they showed a lot of videos of North America, for example, because North America is such a big continent and the whole thing gets tilled. Mm. The whole thing gets tilled. And that's a massive desert. And they're tilling already dead land anyway, right? And if you could think about think of like the middle of Canada down to the panhandle of Texas to the Appalachian Mountains to California. I mean, that's a huge, huge space that used to just suck down carbon because it used to be one big mass of grassland. And there were tens of millions of ruminants like bison and elk and everything, pooing everywhere and farting everywhere, and there wasn't a problem with the environment because it was being recaptured, you see. So yes, no tilling. Gardening can be difficult with that, but it's kind of cool. It's weeds aren't bad, you know. There's sometimes you can also start to plant companion plants next to some of your plants that will protect your plants. You know, there are species of plants out there like borage that you can grow really well in the UK. And it just attracts hoverflies, right? Mm. The hoverflies just seem to love the flowers. And then hoverflies lay their eggs on it, right? And they're little hoverfly larvae, right? And same thing with ladybugs, ladybirds, you call them ladybirds. Yeah. They love these particular, there's certain plants that will bring in ladybugs, and ladybug larvae is another one. They will just devour aphids. So if you plant them around your leafy greens, all of a sudden you've created, this is an example of the symbiotic relationship where this borage plant, which is kind of pretty, it's a weed really, a nice purple flower. People would just pull it out before because they thought, oh, it's going to take the water or something like that. But now it's actually acting as a protector to your spinach. You know, you can sit there and watch the little baby larva. Just, you watch this little war happen. These aphids are just getting slaughtered. You think, oh, that's great. You know, there's all kinds of little things like that, you know, that you can experiment. Some of them go wrong. Some of them go bad. You can also set up plants that are like sacrificial. You know, you might take a basil plant and you go like, all right, we're going to put you here, because we know they're going to go for you first. Oh. You're going to save all those guys over there. And you see this poor basil plant, just take it, because you can see where the pests are coming. That's okay too, right? He saved everybody else. You know, you sacrifice one, and you know, the little, when you're left, whatever's left of him, you pull it up and give it to the chickens, and then they get to eat it. So, sorry, go ahead.
No, I love that. And actually, I was just going to say, like, in terms of what you've just said, the whole, like, veganism, I mean, I'm actually vegetarian. I have been, like, since I was a kid, you know, really tiny. But this whole veganism movement, and you know, this beyond meat, you know, we're all going to be eating processed soya, like, do you not just think, oh my god, it's like watching a car crash in slow motion sort of about to happen with what's going to happen?
I think
to
it's
the
crazy
earth.
Well, soy is just you know, I go between sometimes I just eat only plants for a week. Sometimes I don't, but soy is something I won't put in my body. You know, it's a legume. You know, you can't eat it raw. You know, I've always thought if you can't eat it raw, you probably shouldn't stick it in your mouth. Like, a lot of beans will just kill you if you eat them. Like, if you eat them raw, like, just actually, like, take just any bean other than a sugar snap pea, right? You can eat raw, but it's kind of been designed that way recently. You know, so soy, there's just so much of it. Now, that's, again, soy is part of a commodity system, right? There's people working on futures contracts on that. It's there's soy farmers. There's a big long chain. Impossible Burger and Beyond Burger are part of that system. So they're part of a movement to you know, I heard lately that they want to start taxing meat, things like that. I think the whole thing is just weird because you're actually making a fake piece of meat to make it look like meat, to make it taste like meat, telling people that meat's bad for you, but eat this, even though it's not really meat, but it looks like meat because you really want it, because your body kind of wants it. I think that whole thing's kind of strange. I feel like it's going to fizzle out. But soy, I mean, that's another plant that, you know, it's mass produced as a monoculture. Soy, corn, soy and corn are the two worst for the environment, I would say, right now that they're growing, unfortunately.
What about wheat? And, like, you know, particularly, I mean, I have a theory that, you know, so many people are gluten intolerant or wheat intolerant nowadays, like, not necessarily, is it because of the glyphosate that's being put on it rather than, you know, our crops are not healthy, you know, and realizing, listening to you talk again, I've never really looked into it before, but I'm thinking, if that's how, you know, what you're saying, soy is farmed and it's genetically modified and you can put all this stuff and it's resistant to it, I mean, how bad must this food be for us?
I don't know as much about wheat. I mean, the wheat now is different than it was 100 years ago. You know, I mean, back to the paleo side of things, and it, you know, it's something that humans have only been eating at max about 12,000 years. Now, they're at max, most of us probably come from descendants from about 6,000 years, really, when they started cultivating grains, right? Homo sapiens, at least. You know, there might have been if you want to get really crazy down the rabbit hole, there might have been splashes of different civilizations 20,000 years ago that had it for 500 years and then lost it. But for the most part, our bodies haven't been processing it that long, you know. But so if you look at human history, right? If you look at human history, which the furthest human they've got back, they've identified as a human, an actual human, not a Homo erectus, right? But a human is 300,000 years, right? And so if you look at, let's say the 10,000 year mark for eating grain, you know, what is that like 2% of human evolution? Well, you can't evolve. You're already human, you're human, right? So humans have been eating grains for about 2% of the human history. If you take Homo erectus now, you know, you want to go back 2 million years, you know, the point where an upright walking hominid's brain just doubles in size, right? Now it's upright walking, it can throw. That's like 2 million years. That's like 1/8%, right, that humans have been eating grains. Okay. Now, I have a theory. This is just my theory, and I've no scientific backing whatsoever on my theory.
No, that's fine.
But I think that the most intelligent human in history would have been the humans right before 10,000 BC, right before grains were discovered. So meaning, let's just say you took from around the world, 10,000 BC, right? Around the world, you're able to take a newborn baby and bring them to the future. So from China, from North America, from Europe, take 1,000 babies, right? One day old, assuming that there's no problem with disease in the modern world and the atmosphere, et cetera. And you raise them as humans here with moms here and families here in this world, 1,000 of them. And then you just took a random control group of 1,000 kids from the modern era. I think those 1,000 from the 10,000 BC would outperform them in every single which way you can think of. Everything from athletics to the business, to being successful, to everything. They just would have absolutely crushed them because they come from a time when survival was just really, really hard, right? Natural selection was at its finest. When you have grains, right? What happened with grains was all of a sudden, you know, humans were always nomadic. And this segues back in the permaculture, by the way. Humans were always nomadic, so they moved with the land. They didn't have a lot of possessions with them because that was weight. You had pretty much your weapons and whatever you could drag around as a house. And you followed the migration of animals. And if there was anything wrong with you, like your sight was bad, you weren't that smart, or even if you snored, you just weren't going to make it. You weren't going to make it. You had to be, you know, you might have been, sadly, there was probably, you know, there's a lot of child death, but because they couldn't keep up. Okay. Now you get to 5,000, 4,000 BC, you get to, you know, the 1600s, you know, all of a sudden people stop moving. And whereas humans in the Paleolithic would have had children maybe every 3 to 4 years, because you wouldn't have had one baby and then just had another baby when you're breastfeeding and you're on the move. You want to breastfeed as long as you could. And then when your kid can walk and keep up, that's when you'd have another kid. Mm. Agriculture comes around, monoculture agriculture, grain agriculture comes around, and now it's about staying put and farming this land and having this grain now, and there's walls, so no mountain lions are going to get you anymore, and there's protection, and now you're having a baby every year, right? It's just because there's this grain input. And there's a huge, much better survival rate. And that's when you start getting families, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 kids in this family that are all separated by a year, 18 months, right? Some of them are Irish twins, right? Yeah. And now everybody gets to live, okay? Which is great, you know, because I probably would have died early. I had a disease when I was born and I would have never made it, but which is a result of this de-evolution, let's call it, right? And so then you have these, you know, humans that are surviving, which is we're all a result of, and they end up having kids and the same thing happens. And so I think we're kind of de-evolved since the advent of grain, personally. If that makes any sense. I don't think we're as intelligent and performance-based as we were then. That's just a theory I have, no, just based on that assertion that survival rates went way up and everybody got to reproduce, which is great. We're here for that.
No, that makes sense. I can see that completely. I think harder lives definitely make you stronger. As they say, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I think that's in many aspects, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I was going to say on that hunter and gatherer, one was leave on that hunter gatherer thing. I was going to leave one more. We've heard about people going to visit the Hadza, right? In Africa. Well, it's called a fecal insertion.
Yeah, tell me. I have very vaguely, but tell me. Yeah.
So the Hadza are a tribe of modern day hunter and gatherers. Their life has not changed ever, and they still follow the animals, and they still hunt, and they still live outside, and they're one of the last few tribes. And it's really sad because they're really running out of food, and they're running out of tribal lands, and there's a lot of problems with the government, and they're eating they're not eating the stuff that they used to, but they're still doing it. But their guts are amazing. Their guts are amazing. Their bodies are amazing. Their teeth are amazing. And so there are people basically going over there I'm trying to put this in the best way possible. And they're basically taking their feces and having it implanted into themselves. So that will, what the bacteria and all the organisms that are in theirs, these hunter-gatherers, are now spreading through their body, and people are apparently feeling much better for it because they're getting this really natural human gut biome put back into their body through their colon. Just a little bit, just enough to start, take the body over. It's like a detox almost.
I've heard of that, but not in respect of this particular tribe, you know. And God, that makes, I've just heard of it through, you know, healthy individuals donating. But actually, you know, how healthy is anyone that lives in this Western world and has this Western diet? So God, yeah, that's really interesting. I'm gonna put that in the show notes. What they called again? Sorry, that I'm making trying to make notes.
Hadza, spelled H-A-D.
Yeah.
Z-A. Do you follow Paul Saladin? Dr. Paul Saladin. Follow him on Instagram. He's more carnivore.
Yeah.
He's like he's an MD, but he's into the more of the carnivore diet. So he actually went and lived with him for a while. And so he followed him around and all that kind of thing. But check him out. They're a really cool tribe. It's sad to see what's happening to them, but he's trying to find a way to get their hunting grounds back. But I guess back to permaculture. The cool thing about permaculture here now is what we're talking about is if the whole world went permaculture, first of all, there'd be tons of food, lovely food. There'd be a lot more farming jobs. Like the world doesn't need bigger farms. It needs more family farms, sort of small to mid-sized farms, you know, around the whole world, right? So, and this idea of a farmer being this sort of dirty guy with overalls, this a sustenance farmer, this barely surviving from the Dust Bowl of depression in America, and he's got to give his kids away and all that. That's not what a permaculture farmer is. A permaculture farmer does really well in life. Like they make a pretty good living, a really good living, the really good ones. They're almost more of a scientist. They're like, you know, so ecology becomes the number one science you want to learn about. You need to learn about ecology and learn a lot about plants. You need to learn about soil, biology, chemistry. It's more about these types of things in the natural world. And so the world needs more of these types of farms. And the cool thing about it, you know, there's small permaculture farms and there's big permaculture farms when it makes sense in scale, like in a grassland or in a massive forest, you know. But the cool thing about it is they're so wild that you can actually go camping in them still. So they serve as wild places, right? Like a permaculture farm can, some of them can be literally just wild forests, you know, that happen to grow different foods inside them that can be harvested without affecting the forest. Different animals can grow in them. And these animals, the cool thing about permaculture and animals is, you know, it's another person to follow is Alan Savory, and the Savory Institute. I would follow him. So he's more specifically on how to use animals within regenerative agriculture. It's based on a mimic nature system. So animals, if you're going to have animals and you're going to grow them for food, as far as they're concerned, like, everything's perfect. Like, there's lots of food. There's a herd. Like, they're always being moved, right? So there's this concept called rotational grazing where you move it's basically a big massive electrical fence, and people go, electrical fence, I can do that. It's like, no. They like to be somewhat tight, but they feel sort of secure with it. Because in their world, they're like, wait a minute, we're moving as a herd. Because you move this fence twice a day. So they're always on new grass, always on new grass. The grass that they leave behind never gets damaged. It actually gets disturbed in the natural way, right? The grass actually wants to be eaten. It actually wants what's coming out of the cow, but it doesn't want it too long. It only wants it for a half a day. Because in nature, herds just move slowly over the grassland. In old school free range thinking, it was like, just give them a big area to eat on. And then but what happened was they would trample here, eat. And when that was gone, they'd come back to where they were, where this new seedlings are just starting, they trample it again, now they kill it. So it never worked. You have to move them and not let them go back to where they were. So these animals, right? They live this life. This is the way I look at it. Like, they live this life where, like, wait a minute, we're constantly on new grass, or if it's chickens, we're in new forest. But no, nobody seems to be, like, none of us seem to be dying. Like, you don't have to see your calf get, you know, pulled down by 10 wolves and eaten alive. Like, they don't know that. Now, you know, they eventually will die, but there's ways to do that too. Called the Tony Soprano method, you know, where you can sort of kill them without them knowing. I mean, that's where that's the only thing. That's the only part. That's the hard part of the whole thing. But up until the point they die, they live a really amazing life. You know, and you're trying to build them into the ecosystem. So there's a farm we filmed where. So like in the UK, there's these, you call them cops, right? A copse is usually the north side of a piece of farmland where there's woods growing, but it's kind of steep. And because there's woods growing, it's on the north side. It's always been in the history of England useless, or the UK useless as farmland because of the angle. It's the north side. It's never going to get sun. It was useless. And they'd use it just for wood. But now there's farmers that are starting to realize that, well, we don't have to plant grains there, right? Or graze cows there, but like chickens and pigs, they actually love forests. Like, pigs love forests. Like, they don't have a lot of fur because they're actually forest creatures, right? And chickens really love forests. And this guy that we went and filmed, he had figured out how to get the chickens and the pigs to coexist. So there's like chickens like walking around on the top of a pig, picking off its ticks, and these pigs are like, thanks. And then like these foxes are like, because pigs can be pretty mean, right? A pig can be pretty mean. These foxes are kind of like, we want to get to the chickens, but these pigs look really tough. And so the chickens are kind of like, nah, you can't get it, you know. And they created this relationship where they're hanging out together. They're just living in a forest, though. And the farmer figured out, you know, you can shaker train animals. As long as you're giving them a little food, they'll stay, right? And they know where home's at. And so they're just roaming around this forest, pack of pigs and a bunch of chickens running around. And the chickens are climbing up in the trees at night, coming back down, you know. And these particular chickens weren't hens. They were all the leftover roosters, the cockerels, right? Yeah. From when you hatched the chicken. So a lot of people would just automatically, a lot of industrial agriculture will just kill the cockerels when they're little babies, right? So this guy took the cockerels and let them hang out the pigs, and they grew up, and then they had a good life until he harvested the cockerels, and then you had meat. So it wasn't a waste. And he wasn't hardly spending any money on the feed because it's like the forest was feeding him. There's bugs and grubs and all these things in the forest that chickens love. He wasn't like throwing a million chickens in there. It was just few chickens and a few pigs. And that was an example of the symbiotic relationship on the Atlantic. That's all over the UK. You know, and you still make your wood out of it.
Yeah, I'm going to put a link to your video because I saw that and I just thought, how lovely that they're living like that. So that's really, yeah, really, really good. It's just sensible. It makes me very skeptical as to why we haven't been empowered to do these farming methods. I mean, obviously, it's because there's no money to be made, is there, if we were all self-sufficient?
Well,
and
well, there is. You can. This guy was making that particular farm. I don't know how many acres it was, but you can. You know, you can make a good living.
Well, I guess the individual can, but the corporations can't. I guess it's harder to commercialize.
The big corporations, yeah, they could on a smaller scale, but it really works better. Somehow, this kind of thing, it works better as like, you know, look, a family farm is a business as far as I'm concerned. Mm. Right.
Yeah.
You can make it a business and, you know, you've got relatives that can work on it. And it can go to the community, but it can also be injected into the bigger cities as well.
Yeah.
So it can happen. Again, it really, really comes down to this belief that Earth is overpopulated. That's one. Then there's this pessimistic view of it's all over and we're just like, it's all, you know, it's done. There's the world's overpopulated. We're going to pollute the planet. Climate change is here. We can't do anything about it. And that's another thing. Like, they feel like they can't do anything about it. We can. I'm optimistic. I think we're going to turn this whole thing around. Just basically by once people realize that we can actually feed it's very, very possible if we do this. It's just that governments are so in bed with these big agricultural companies, you know, these agricultural companies from America, especially. You know, there's only a few of them. They're massive and they're deep. And, you know, the people running these things are like the grandkids of the ones that started it. You know, it's a big, massive, multi-billion dollar company that's connected to war as well, you know, because they're, you know, some of these companies are, you know, up close with, you know, different peoples in the American military, and they'll go to Africa. And they'll say, look, if you allow us to have a base here, et cetera, this kind of thing, then, you know, we can make sure you have access to these particular pesticides and fertilizers. And you can quickly grow crops, these bumper crops, which it's a quick fix, right? So it does work, industrial agriculture, but it's a quick fix. It's a quick fix that you're going to run out of not the long game, it's the quick fix, right? Mm. They'll get these quick yields, quick sale, quick money, get it onto the exchange and sell. And so there's a big massive problem with this, you know, and I think some of your other podcasts I have listened to, you know, you'll see the same thing with the pharmaceutical companies that do this, the same thing with governments as well, you know.
There's a price to be paid for everything, I think.
Price to be paid. And a lot of people will say, well, these pharmaceutical companies and these foundations, you know, they would never do that. And it's just like as a business person, I go, well, they would. It's like, well, billionaires don't want, they, why would they want more money? I'm like, of course they want more money.
Yeah.
If you got 10 billion, you're going to want 20 because that other guy over there has got 40 and you want to catch him. And you literally are that greedy. And to think that they're not, that they think that they have enough, it's just like, wow. You know, and if you're, you know, nothing beats market manipulation when you actually have help from the government and you make it a law. That is like the gold, holy golden grail of market manipulation, when you actually have, you know, force and legislation behind you and military muscle to actually enforce it. And you see that going along with everything that's going on today, and it's happening with food. And so, but I feel like people are waking up a little bit to all of this, and just wish, you know, people would start to realize that just knowing it's good enough, just being aware that you can just, there's a lot of power in just saying, there's not a lot I can do about this. That's bullshit.
Yeah. Okay?
Just more people saying that. You don't have to throw a big massive revolution or Molotov cocktails. You don't have to do that because that's kind of what you want. You just have to say, yeah. Bullshit. I can't do anything about it. But that person also thinks it's bullshit, and that person over there thinks it's bullshit. But none of us just have to just sit here and just all realize this is bullshit. You know, it's kind of my thoughts on that.
No, I like that a lot. So people that are listening and thinking, you know, okay, this sounds amazing. Like you obviously did it in your place in London. You know, what is there an average size? You know, could you do this with like an acre, or would you need acres and acres? Or like, again, does it depend? You know, is there sort of,
to make a living on it, or just to partake in it?
Either, I guess. What's your view on both?
Living on it, there's some people that are doing some amazing things with microgreens, for example. You know, a microgreen, for example, if you can grow you can grow microgreens in really small places, indoors with special lights, in water, just pure water. And microgreens are something, for example, that chefs at 5-star restaurants will pay for because it's fresh. And if you've got a microgreen business, for example, in London, in just a bedroom with a pond in it, you could grow enough microgreens and actually go over to an amazing restaurant, and they'll buy that right away for top pound, you know. So there's some people that'll make money in something like that without using any pesticides. Now it's a little bit of a, they'll grow different species in there. Maybe they'll grow fish in the water, you know, things like that. There is endless. I think it's good to start just learning about it, and to start with just one box. If you have space for one box, and to plant like a few things, you know, you can start in the spring. It's always nice to start in the spring with little pots of things, right? Because then you can actually, you put a little bit of soil in, and you put a little bit of, and then you plant your little seed and you put it by the window, and then you can kind of watch it grow. And it's almost kind of, you, if you're going to start it off with the whole birth of the whole thing, which is actually planting this little seed, and then watching it just grow. And then you start to get attached to that. My grandmother used to love that. Like, that was her favorite part about it, was watching the little seed come up, you know? And then if you have even just a window and you can grow something, then try it. I mean, a tomato, if you have a south-facing window in the UK, you know, you can grow a tomato plant. If get a dangling ones, let's say, because they'll just dangle down. And, you know, just little cherry tomatoes. That's fine. That's all that you can do. But at least you grew some food. Of course, in the UK, herbs, an herb box is always a winner, right? So rosemary, thyme, and stuff like that, because that's something you could almost use every day in your cooking. And at least, you know, you're getting something. Now, chickens are actually pretty easy, and you get a pretty big bang for your buck there on sort of protein and fat with them. And they're like the best garbage disposals in the world. Like, they'll eat, they ate 90% of the food waste from the kitchen they would consume and turn into eggs. And of course, you can use them around your garden, where you create their run around the veg garden, but they can't get into the veg garden because they'd love to get in there. But now, you know, they're patrolling around the veg garden. So any snail bolting for the lettuce, they'll pick it up. You know, slugs, they'll go after them. Any of the other bugs, they'll have a chance at. Caterpillars, so they can feed off, you know. England's really great for, UK is really great for that, because there's so much rain and plants grow so quickly. The wild plants, you know, they grow so quickly, that all helps feed the chickens in a way. Even if they don't eat the plants, it draws in food sources for them. You can definitely do chickens with the right system in an urban environment in London, and it's basically called the deep litter system. And it can be kind of complex, but it's by far the best. I did it for years. It's basically taking dry carbon, and you put it like straw, and you keep throwing it into their coop, and it stacks up and it stays really dry. And then you throw their feed on top, which sounds crazy, but the feed trickles to the bottom, and they just cannot resist digging for it. Like, they'll chase one little morsel of like grain to the bottom of the coop. They'll dig a hole this big, looks like a nuclear bomb went off, just to get it. And they get down to the bottom and they come back up, and they'll spend the whole day doing that. A happy chicken's a busy chicken. Chickens are busy, they're happy, right? In industrial world, they live in little boxes and they're going psychotic. It's really, really sad. But the chickens I always had were really, really happy. But what they did was they stirred up all that carbon and kept everything dry. So their poo always dries instantly. And then that turns into dust at the very bottom of the coop, which once a year, you scoop out the coop, throw it under the garden, and you've got the best nitrogen, natural nitrogen in the world. And your vegetable garden just blows up like popcorn with amazing food. And I never had to spray the birds with mites. I never had mites. That's always a big problem. Mites, how do you know about mites? Mites, skin disease. Never had to clean the coop.
That's amazing, because I've wanted to get chickens for ages, but I've been really like, just, you know, with all the other commitments and the kids and work and everything, and I was like, oh, I don't want to have something else to have to clean up and look after. So
there's a way to do it. There's a way to do it where you could literally, basically the only work you're doing is getting the eggs, filling up the water like every 3 weeks. Right? Because you can put like a little nipple system where it's like a little dinghy, and then their water never gets dirty. I don't know why anybody would have a watering system with an actual like cup. It's just going to get dirty. And like I can't, people still do it. I'm like, how do they even sell these things? Like, how do people not know about the nipple system, which the water stays completely clean. They hit a little button and the water comes out and they drink it. And it's like, you could fill that thing up every 3 weeks. You can have a massive like feeder thing where they have their own food that comes out, you know, they step on this little paddle and then the food just trickles out and they can eat that. And of course they're eating the food in the coop. Again, it would really just be getting the eggs, which if you're gone for two weeks on holiday, you can get neighbors to do that. Trust me. You say, oh, here's a key. Have all the eggs you want. They'll be over there because they're the best eggs ever, right? They're always the best eggs ever. I mean, the chickens we had, you named them, you stop naming after a while, because then every once in a while one will start to wobble when it gets really old and you eat it. It's really weird. And your daughter goes to school and says, yeah, we ate bubbles today. there's nothing goes to waste. Everything. I mean, we brought a bunch of mackerels from the, you know, we ate a big full size mackerel, head and everything, right? Head and tail. And we baked them with some other things, and then we finished the mackerels, but left the heads and the eyeballs and everything. I'm like, I wonder if I throw like four of these we had like eight chickens in there. Throw these mackerel carcasses in there, what'll happen? And they went ballistic. They were running around like dinosaurs with these things, like just running around with mackerel carcasses, and they just ate them. They just ate these mackerel. They eat everything. They eat everything except onions. And garlic.
That's so funny.
Yeah, all the garden waste, everything, anything from your garden, like if you mowed your lawn or clipped your hedges, throw that in there. They'll eat it.
Really?
And if they don't eat it, they're just going to mix it back into that mulch, which is getting spun with the nitrogen, which then goes to the bottom of the coop because this little morsel exchange, they chase that little morsel down. They get the reward. They come back up and they do it again. You can also do funny things like, you know, when you have a big chunk of like cauliflower and you got the stem left, or there's some old cauliflower, you can hang that in the coop and then it'll swing around and you just watch them be out there for hours. You know, they're fun to watch. Chickens are fun. And but you don't get, I have harvested a few, you know, and they're not hard to harvest because they're not your friends. When you walk out, it forgets who you are, first of all. And then it looks at you like this eye like that, just like a dinosaur would. And it their depth perception's so bad, they're actually looking at you because they're like, wait, can I eat that? And you get close and like, no, I'm not going to eat that. It's too big. But it would. Trust me. If the sizes were different, it would plop right down there without all. You could have known it for 5 years and taken care of it and everything. It'll just pop. It'll suck you right up. So. Well,
that's so funny. So what I'm conscious of time, you know, so I mean, it's amazing. It just sounds like there's so much, like literally so much to learn, and that's what I'm finding every area I start looking into now on anything. I'm like, it's just you go down a rabbit hole and there's just so much information, you know, that we don't know and we're not told. So people that are interested, you know, what resources, or you know, where should they start if they're thinking, I really want to learn more, I want to see if I can use this in my garden or allotment or whatever. Well, just where's a good place?
Well, watch Kiss the Ground. And you know what? There really should be a movement. If you watch Kiss the Ground, you remember there was that scene where they had that like split screens where there's like 10 screens. And then they had different aspects of regenerative agriculture. They had like waste harvesting, cattle grazing, this forestry. And they only covered like four or five topics in that whole film. But they actually showed this big grid of the like 100 different parts of the rabbit hole of regenerative agriculture. I really wish people would make a move to take that documentary and turn it into a series to start going over all of the different aspects, because that costs a lot of money to make that. And I'd like it if somebody could somehow, I'm sure those guys would love to make more of those films and go over those other parts, because they're all very interesting and they're all really amazing. When they all come together, the picture even gets bigger. Okay. So if you go back and watch that movie, try and go back and remember what the other quadrants were of these other aspects of regenerative agriculture and start to read about those subjects. There's a guy you can follow. Well, so I said already a good resource is Savory Institute. He's got a TED Talk, Alan Savory. Jeff Lawton, spelled with a G.
Yeah.
Now I would say he would be one of the sort of the top tier, best of the best permaculturists in the whole world.
Was that Lawton, did you say?
Jeff Lawton, yeah, he spells his name. I would probably follow him the most because he's going to be the most technical.
Okay.
Like he's going to know everything. He's on Instagram, but he actually has a website and you can take courses from him.
Very amazing.
And if you really wanted to get into it, that's where to start. Now, just taking the course, it's going to give you the sort of outline. You know, you have to take the time to be inquisitive enough to want to learn about this stuff, right? And, you know, one of the things is you want to learn it. You want to catch the bug, if you will, on the trail. So another thing you can do is to follow some actual permaculture farmers. Now, the ones I'm following are, for example, is White Oak Pastures in Georgia.
White Old Pastures. I'm going to put all
White Oak.
I'm going to put links. Oak. To all of this in the show notes. I'll put links.
Yeah. Now, if you follow them, they're an example of a larger permaculture system that's working really, really well. It's family run, but they're like a business, right? And they're going to be feeding tens of thousands of people.
Amazing.
Okay? And that's one based in Georgia. There's some, I guess, cute little ones like Cedar Springs Farm. I like them. Cedar, C-E-D-A-R. They're like a little family in Colorado. And yeah, I guess if they're especially younger people out there that want to make a life out of it, you know, they've got time on their hand, right? Like they've got more time to actually build something. You know, permaculture farm done right, you know, you want basically an orchard forest system, right? In most parts of the world, you want an orchard forest system. It's called a food forest. So you need to have a polyculture of a variety of nuts, a variety of fruit trees, a variety of trees that are only designed to make fence posts in 15 years from now, a variety of other things that are going to be like a hardwood to make furniture. All, you know, but a lot of those things take time. Like a food forest will take 10, 15 years. But if you're in your early mid 20s and you just started a family and you're able to get a piece of land and do something like that, then you actually have the time to start it while you're young and don't have kids that are older, for example. So that's a young family, for example, that's done just that, Cedar Springs.
Yeah, that's great to get the two, you know, the two differences of the large one and then the small one. So yeah, right. I'm going to go and look them up.
For sure. Of course, Jeff Lawton's the place to go to get the actual educational side of it. Alan Savory, we just went to that. Let's see who else we got here. Yeah, I would just start with that for right now.
really keen to learn more. And I just think it's exciting. I feel really, you know, what you've said about actually we can feed the world, you know, it's really positive.
Not only that, we can feed it 10 times over. That's the crazy part about it. Like 10 times over. I'm saying like 100 billion people. Like we're never going to have 100 billion people. But if we did, we could. And we could actually still go camping and not see a person. That's how crazy it is. You know, because all of a sudden farms become forests, like farms become wild places to go hiking, you know, with very, very slight control in them. And there's different levels. I mean, some farms can be more controlled and some are bigger and less controlled, but you know, there's a lot of systems there that I could get into that we'd be here forever. You know, that population thing we were talking about. And we were talking about why people believe that, right? Because it doesn't really make any sense. Like, why is 7.7 billion people too many? Like, it's a big number, but Earth's pretty big too, right? And the media seems to be pushing that narrative because it supports industrial agriculture. And like, people have just been like almost brainwashed into believing it. Like, no matter what you tell them, the world's overpopulated. That's happened as well with the oil industry. Now, I'm not I mean, obviously I want a world without burning fossil fuels, but right now we need them. But that's an example where the media has kind of done this sort of the same thing, but they still want it, right? They've created this idea that there's a scarcity in oil. And you'll see a lot of permaculture videos will start off with that there's a scarcity of oil. And a lot of them have been led to believe that. But I actually went into the research on oil and did calculations, which I'll share with you right now, as to why there's actually shitloads of it. Okay. And what it was is I figured out how much oil the world burns per second. I was like, that's what I started with. Like, how much oil do we actually burn per second? Right. And it was 40,000 gallons per second. That's the answer. The answer is 40,000 gallons per second of oil. And I said, what does 40,000 gallons look like falling? Like, if it was a waterfall of oil and 40,000 gallons were falling, what would it look like? So I thought, well, I wonder how many gallons Niagara Falls dumps. So I looked up Niagara Falls, how many gallons per second? And it was like 200,000. Like, okay, that's not it. So I went to the second biggest waterfall, it was like 180, and the third and fourth. Anyway, I got to the 16th biggest waterfall that actually drops 40,000 gallons of water a second. And it's called Jog Falls, J-O-G, and it's in India. So you can look up Jog Falls, and they've got some funny music to it, and you can see Jog Falls, and it's a beautiful waterfall, and it's dumping a lot of water. And you go, wow, that's a lot of water. You can actually see what 40,000 gallons of oil falling looks like. So then I thought, like, well, like, if it was falling and he had a container, like, how long would it take to, say, fill up? Like, if Lake Tahoe, so that was the example I used, Lake Tahoe, which is a lake in California, right? A natural lake, very deep. It's about 400 meters deep, really, which is really deep. It's by, you know, close to Burning Man. It's on the way to Burning Man. I've never been, but anyway, it's a big lake. Like, if Lake Tahoe was completely empty and it was like a big bowl, and Jog Falls was dumping water into an empty Lake Tahoe, like, how long would it take to fill up Lake Tahoe? Have a guess.
I have no idea. I don't know. Tell me.
32 years.
Bloody hell.
It would take 32 years for Jog Falls to fill up Lake Tahoe at 40,000 gallons. Then I figured out, like, you know, 40,000 gallons times 60 makes 1 minute times 24 hours. The whole life, right? You can work it out, right? It would take 31 years. So in 31 years, we've burned enough oil to fill up Lake Tahoe. Now, go to Google Maps, look at Lake Tahoe, and there's Lake Tahoe. And now zoom out. Lake Tahoe gets smaller. Zoom out, Lake Tahoe. Zoom out, zoom out, zoom out, zoom out, zoom out. You keep zooming out. You don't zoom out much further than, like, I don't know, 80,000 feet, and 90,000 feet. You can't see Lake Tahoe anymore. Like, you can't see Lake Tahoe anymore. It's gone. It's disappeared. Lake Tahoe's gone. One of these massive lakes. You see California and Nevada and Arizona. Yeah. And Lake Tahoe's like a little dot. You get out to space, you can't see it. And that's how much oil we've burnt in the last 32 years, right? And then I talked to like a friend of my oil, like I was drinking with a friend in the oil company. He's like, man, we got shitloads of it. There's tons of oil on the earth. Now, I don't want him to get the oil. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we should just be burning oil, because I think the oil is kind of like a glue. It's like the muscle tendons of earth. You know, that oil needs to be in the crust there. We don't need to be sucking out, hollowing out earth, right? But the media, and even in trickled into regenerative agriculture, is we're running out. We've got to do something. Well, that creates a scarcity, which drives the price of oil up, right? So,
yeah, that's amazing. You did that. I love the fact you did that. Crazy, but that's really, do you know what? Nothing surprises me anymore. Like, in terms of what we've been told, by the media on everything, just seems to be an untruth. So that doesn't, but it's just the more you look in more places, I just find it shocking. You know, well, nothing surprises me, so I shouldn't be shocked. But yeah, that is, I've never thought about oil.
It's these movements and narratives. There are two groups that hate each other that actually share a common narrative, and that are vegans and the industrial agricultural world, right? Now, they hate each other, but one thing that they share in common is the narrative that meat's destroying the planet, right? And that because of overpopulation, we have to become vegan. We have to become vegan because of overpopulation. So we can't all eat meat because there's not enough meat to go around. Okay, that's the vegan narrative. And industrial agriculture is like, no. Yeah, we agree with them. Not really, but we agree with the overpopulation part, and there's too many people, we can't feed them, so we need industrial agriculture, right? So there's a common, a common shared thing there. All of this can be one with just basically a permaculture regenerative-based system, a lot more jobs, amazing food, of diversity of food would be amazing. And the planet would just go, it would just go, because it was like getting a back scratch. it would chill. And then we
wait. Yeah. I think it's got so much scope for like wider, like for at the individual level as well, because I think we've become, not everyone, but majority of people, we're so disconnected and don't have that autonomy and self-accountability and responsibility, and we're reliant on systems. And actually, it's really empowering. Like, you know, my husband and I are trying to find land. So, you know, I'm really interested to learn more, as is he. Yeah, and I think to be self-sustainable right now, it would be amazing. And like, to hear that, I love it. So I think, yes, everyone should try and do their little part, even if you're just growing tomatoes, you know, on your windowsill. Sure.
Cooking becomes way more interesting too. And, you know, that's a big part of it. You get into the culinary side of things, but nothing tastes better than your own food that you grew and you picked with your hand. It just doesn't taste any better. I mean, and then it becomes about this relationship with the kitchen and the land and the food and the conversation. And, you know, you realize that all of a sudden you're not that much further than what you're no different now than the hunters and gatherers. This is what they did. Their life was around their food, and their life was sitting around while they prepared the food and talking. And then they'd sit around either on the floor or at a table, and then they talk more, but eat. And they tell stories about it, and they talk about the food, and, you know, and that's what it is to be human. And I guess we have to, like when you look at the number one first rule in permaculture, when you come to a site, is observation. And giving animals, for example, a mimic nature system where, you know, cows get to do cow stuff, pigs get to do pig things, chickens get to do chicken things. They have to be able to do these natural instincts that they have. And, you know, for humans to truly be happy, I think we have to do these very human things, like being with our friends and family and sharing food together and growing food together. And that's when people are really happy. I mean, how fun is it to sit in the kitchen with like a bottle of wine and cook and have some music on and everybody's having a good laugh? And, you know, that's the best. That's the magic of the world, isn't it? I think.
Yes, totally. And yeah, that's a really good note to sort of end it on and wrap up on, I think, because that is what I think so many my friends, you know, that's what we all want, to go back. We think we're so advanced in our industrial world, you know, on the corporate treadmill, and actually,
yeah,
I think they had it sussed many, many, many years ago. So I hope we'll go back to that. Yeah, it's been really, really, really fascinating, and I'm really can't wait to learn more. But I think that it is just going to be a whole another rabbit hole to go down and information to bring in. But I think we'll start with the chickens and go from there.
Yeah, if you have any questions, just call me. I'm happy to help you.
Thank you so, so much.